Thank you, Caitlin. I'll just do a quick recap then. So good morning, everyone, and welcome to the November 17th, 2021 meeting of the Transit Commission. We've done roll call, and only Commissioner Williams is absent today. And now we'll talk about what we're going to do today. So as you're aware, the Transit Commission received its portion of the 2022 budget at our last meeting, and we referred it to this meeting today. We will get to that budget in short order, but first I'd like to explain the format for today's meeting. In keeping with our format from previous meetings, last year's budget meeting, we will start with the Confederation Line and bus service update from the General Manager. After that, we will consider the draft 2022 budget. I've asked that commissioners provide any motions to the coordinator in advance of today's meeting. If the commissioners have not yet done so, I would ask that they please email their motions to the coordinator at their earliest opportunity. I will ask that these motions be moved at the outset of the budget discussion. So to start the meeting, are there any declarations of interest? Okay, seeing none. So we will go to the update. First, the minutes of the Transit Commission meeting of Wednesday, October 20, carried.
Carried.
Thank you. Okay, and the confidential minutes of the Transit Commission meeting of Wednesday, October 20th, are they also carried?
Carried.
Carried.
Thank you. Are the minutes of the Transit Commission meeting of Wednesday, November 3rd, carried?
Carried.
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 And so now we'll go to the Confederation Line update. At this point, we have no delegations. But Renee, our new general manager, Renee Amilcar, will start the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair. If you don't mind, I will make a brief introduction before to go to the presentation. So for those who require the translation, I would like ask you to be prepared because I will switch in French.
Bonjour à tous. Je suis très contente d'être avec vous ce matin.
Welcome, everyone. I'm very happy to be here this morning. I'm starting my fifth week in the city of Ottawa in OC Transpo, and it's by choice that I came here, not by obligation. So it was a source of pride for me. So what I'm talking to you this morning is from the bottom of my heart. In the 5 weeks that I spent with you, I know that I will need you so we can continue to work together and provide an excellent experience to our passengers. I know that on November 5th, when we made our presentation with TRA, our technical briefing, I was really embarrassed by all the inconvenience caused because of the lack of service. But so today, I'm very proud to make my presentation and to tell you that we have 7 trains going, and this since last Friday. I know that yesterday we had a bit of a problem and it raised a lot of discontentment from you. And what I would ask you this morning is not to fall in that trap, because what you have offered me, is your support, all of you, and I thank you. I really rely on this. We can be proud together of this success, because starting on September 20th, following the September 19 derailment, we decided to offer the users a safe service. And for me, safety is the first priority. And I'm very proud that you made this decision to suspend the service despite all the inconvenience. But we have to be proud today that the safety work that needed to be done was done, and will remain vigilant, and we will make decisions that will have an impact on our users. But it will always be to be sure that the safety of our passengers is not at risk. So give us a chance. to deal with this aspect of safety that we sometimes take for granted, and it shouldn't be, because we have to be prudent day after day. And that's a source of pride for me. We can't stop the service for frivolous reasons, no, but we will take that risk if we need to, but we will proceed smartly, and we'll learn from our mistakes, and we'll learn to trust again. Know that it is normal that a train on steel wheels, on a steel rail track, it's noisy. So we've asked our operators to be more vigilant than ever so that we are not faced with such a situation as of September 19. So once again, I ask you to work with us, to be indulgent with us, to continue to be patient, because our goal with my team, the team that I'm very proud of, they're working day and night, truly, with a lot of rigor and empathy for our clients that don't have the service they deserve. But all this is because we want to be proud tomorrow, and we want to be proud with you. Without you, we would not be proud. So now I will go on to my presentation.
Aujourd'hui, ça va être très bref. Vous pouvez aller à la page 1. Ça va être très bref. Ce dont on va discuter avec vous, ça va être une remise de façon sécuritaire.
We'll go to page 1. We'll talk about the safe return to service, what it means, and then we'll talk about the R1 replacement bus service, then ridership, and of course, we'll take the opportunity to give you an update regarding the mandatory vaccination policy. You'll see we have excellent news in this regard. Please know that even if the presentation is brief, it is important that my team be with me and be part of the discussion. So I will be talking to you very briefly, and Troy will continue to explain what it means when TRA gives us the go to resume the service. It was transparent for our clients, it was transparent for you, but there's a lot of work that was done behind the scene. So we'll explain that, and then the star of the hour will also talk to you. So on page 2, a reminder that on November 5th, TRA outlined their assessment of a Rideau Transit Group's return to service plan. It was quite clear that the service was safe to resume, contingent on several factors. So 5 days later, on November 10, our city manager, Mr. Kanalakas, received the approval from TRA that the train could resume service. Our head of safety, too, was in agreement. So it meant that on Friday, November 12, we were able to provide service starting at 5 in the morning. Page 3, what it means is that after resuming the service will gradually increase. Page 3, please. So I can share with you now that tomorrow we'll add one more train. Therefore, we'll have 8 trains rolling starting tomorrow. And this will go on until we get to the end of November and we have the full service, always in a COVID context, that is 11 trains. So we'll have 11 trains for the whole month of December. As you know, we were able since last Friday to offer the train service, be it partial, but service with the R1 buses, and we closely monitored in the train and in the buses. We saw that there were very few passengers. So this is why this led us to decide that starting this morning, the R1 bus replacement service would not be offered. But you can rest assured that if something happens, we will be able to quickly resume that service. It's part of our procedure if should there be a problem on the train line. I can tell you that I come from Montreal, and it was quite frequent that we needed mitigation measures when the metro was not working properly. So that's a great decision because we'll be able to use those buses where we had to reduce the service because of the circumstances. So I take this opportunity also to thank everyone who cooperated so well, because the bus service was provided for 54 days. We have to think about this. We're lucky to have the regular service, then paratranspo, and the LRT service. So our system is quite solid because we were able to maintain the service despite the fact that we didn't have the train for 50-some days. So I'll ask Troy to explain to you what it takes when we have a rolling material like this. What can we do now to make sure that when the service resumes, that it is done in a transparent way for our clients? Thank you.
Thank you, Rana.
And the actions that we took. So if we go to the next slide, that would be fantastic. Great. So, with TRA's oversight over the entire process, the system tested included, the vehicles, the infrastructure, as well as the overall system. So you've heard about how all the vehicles went through a detailed inspection process that was documented and validated prior to the return to service. But, there was static tests that were done in the yard. Then we did tests out on the main line, running the trains for several hours. And then we went into the mock service, and that we looked at everything. We looked at the computer-based train control system, validated the proper functionality of that, running the trains for extended periods of time, using all those switches or crossovers. You recall where we talked about how trains can cross from one track to another, tested all of those, make sure that everything was functioning as per our expectations and as per design. Once that was complete, and as part, and while that was going on, we had operational staff that were out in the stations. They were inspecting the stations, looking for minor things like where we can improve on some cleanliness activities. But this is while making sure that the stations were fit to return to service, and there would be no surprises on that first day back. Again, while the plan was being finalized and while we were working through the mock service. All our staff, all our frontline staff, our electric rail operators, our controllers, our supervisors, all those people, we went through mandatory refresher training for every member of our staff. Obviously a big portion of the focus was the safe return to service, and we're a piece of that. So we wanted to make sure that after that extended shutdown, that our staff were refreshed on all the operating expectations or operating procedures, and it was an opportunity for us to test and make sure that whatever operational issue popped up that we knew what the response would be and we were ready for it. So to that end, throughout the mock service and the system testing, we conducted basically twice a day operational drills. We wanted once again to test our standard operating procedures, make sure that we all retained and remember what we're supposed to be doing in certain situations. The situations that we looked at were simple things like, cell phone dropped on the tracks or a customer activating one of the emergency intercoms. But as well, we tested, the operational responses. Should we have to put a diversion in place, and we have to use those switches and crossovers and and deploy staff to be able to assist customers. We tested all those things and we drilled them. And that was a big part of the mock service. And that's why if customers were watching, they may have seen trains stop and trains move and do different patterns than what they would normally do, because we were doing these drills and exercises, you know, in preparation for the return to service. Throughout the testing and the mock service, our staff were very, very diligent, reported observations, and that helped guide the testing as well as the full system mock service. I think, like customers, there were questions from our staff, and we asked our staff to be, you know, extra diligent in reporting, our usual noises or smells, and, you know, that was expected. We did see that in the early days, and as the testing process continued, it allowed us to refine and make sure that we're ready for that for when we return to service. The early days, we did experience a few, you know, I would say characterize it as, we just had to get into an operational rhythm. So, you know, we anticipated that there was going to be some hiccups or challenges on the return. So, you know, getting back into the process of a launch, launching seven trains in approximately half an hour. You know, new processes in terms of inspections and just getting that rhythm down and making sure that everything's done, you know, obviously safely, reliably, you know, but we also have to make sure that they're done, you know, efficiently as well too. So, you know, work through those challenges in the early days and that's what helped serve to inform the decision to move forward with launching the service that we did. So with that said, I'll turn it over to my colleague at this point, to Pat, and we'll talk about ridership and the mandatory vaccination.
Thanks, Troy. In October, we carried about 100,000 customers fewer than we had in September. But because October normally is one of our busiest months of the year with higher ridership than September, our proportion of where we were pre-pandemic was at 41% rather than the 45% we had been at in September. Paratransport ridership is at 59% of pre-pandemic levels. And of course, we're continuing to watch this closely and making service adjustments as necessary. Those are system-wide numbers, but we're also watching very closely individual routes. Paratransport service levels continue to be sufficient to meet current ridership demand. And in October, all trip requests were fulfilled. We're continuing to try to minimize the number of trips where there is more than one customer in the same vehicle. In October, a very low number of 9% of trips in minibuses were shared. And all trips were single customer only on contracted taxi, except where they were traveling with a companion or a support person. The next slide, please. So the mandatory vaccination policy came into effect across the city on Monday. By this point, 95% of OC Transport staff have provided proof of vaccination and are available for work. And this is very similar to the overall rate for all city staff. Where there are some people who haven't been able to come to work this week, our control center and our dispatch staff and our supervisors on the street are continuing to manage the staffed buses that are available to provide the best possible service overall. And we're not seeing so far any impacts on maintenance of vehicles. Together, even though there's been some small gaps because of absences, overall, we are now running 23% more capacity than we were early last week, because the train brings so much capacity and has freed up the buses that were on the rail replacement service to go back to their normal assignments, either providing service or backing up that service for more reliability. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of our presentation. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Pat and Renee. Appreciate this. So with questions, Commissioner Wright-Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Madame Almokar's comments with respect to, you know, we're all a team and we're trying to get the... Sorry, what was my cat sneezing? Again, we're trying to get this service up and running, and she looks forward to working with all of us. Asking our customers to continue to be patient is not necessarily the best way forward. Our customers, what we have left of them, are out of patience. And quite understandably, right? It's been 2 years of constant issues, and then there were derailments, and then R1. So I just want to sort of temper, you know, the anger that is out there currently, and just sort of, you know, caution against asking our customers to be patient just because they've been really patient. With respect to my questions, can I ask, you said that you're doing some full line testing and testing of emergency procedures. What is the evacuation plan for those folks who are in wheelchairs, who cannot abandon their wheelchairs on the train? They need those mobility devices. What is the evacuation plan for those folks?
Yeah, we, Troy is in charge of that. And maybe Troy, you can explain what is exactly the procedure, please.
Sure. Thank you for the question. Yeah, when it comes to emergency evacuations, obviously that's something that we want to avoid as much as possible. But we have had, to do, train-to-train transfers or evacuations for people due to immobilized vehicles. Whenever we have a situation where a train couldn't get to a station and we have to ask people to, you know, get off the train at that point, we always make sure that we involve our emergency response providers, so fire services attend and assist. We will always send the operational staff to the train to assist the operator in communicating to people what to expect, what's going on, and you know, and that, you know, emergency services are on their way to assist should there be anyone with mobility challenges. The situation, you know, the actual response depends on, you know, a variety of factors, location of the train, number of customers on board, and whether or not there's customers with mobility challenges, with mobility issues that are on the train. We'd largely follow the direction from Ottawa Fire Services in the best way to evacuate the train should there be people with mobility issues on that train. And in very rare occurrences, we haven't had this situation yet. And at the direction of fire services, you know, a customer with a mobility device, we may have to remove them from the train and then get the mobility device afterwards and get that to them. But that's in very rare situations. It hasn't happened yet. And our actual response is really dependent upon the situational factors, and we'll work with the emergency response providers in doing it the best way possible.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, there isn't really a set in stone plan per situation. So train is stopped, not at a station, for example, there isn't a set in stone plan. You essentially rely on Ottawa Emergency Services to provide the advice about how you would evacuate someone who relies on a mobility device off of the train. Is that fair?
No, Mr. Chair, we do have operational plans in place, but those plans need to be tailored to the unique circumstances as to what occurs. So fire services, we will work with our emergency response providers, but we do have plans in place, and, you know, it's deploying staff, where do we need to send staff, you know, to support people at stations, all those types of things are covered in our plans. So we do have plans, but we do need to recognize that they need to be tailored based upon, you know, what circumstances are there. Even in things like the winter and the different seasons, you know, they play a factor in how we would respond to a certain event.
Okay. I think there's some...
Troy, Commissioner, can I just interject something here that might help you? Sure. Troy, isn't there a training film about that? I seem to recall being present when they were doing one of those exercises where they were evacuating people in wheelchairs out of the trains. Is that on a video that could be shared with the commissioner so she could see how that works?
Actually, I'd ask the chair, but the public, so that those who are actually in that situation can feel comfortable that they're, you know, going to be safe and evacuated safely, and that there is a plan. That's
right.
Yeah.
So is that something we can look at, Troy, to see if there is a video that could be posted somewhere or shared?
That's something I could take a look at. I know, Mr. Chair, you were there when we did some operational drills before launch. I know there were some videos taken at that time, and I can see if those can be available for sure. Yeah,
that would be great. I think just for and thank you, Mr. Chair, for your interjection. I do appreciate that. I think just for the comfort of our passengers who do require mobility devices, it would be nice for them to, it would provide them a sense of comfort to know that there are plans in place, that they can see what to expect, right? Because it's bad enough when you're in a stop train that's not at a station, and then to not know what to expect because you need to use a mobility device when everyone else is just sort of milling around. You can understand that would be slightly uncomfortable for them. So I thank you for that. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. Speaking of the testing, So when you were doing the testing for the safe return to service, were there any instances of vehicles that were released into the testing phase onto the tracks, into track testing or into service with issues that were not caught on inspection or require them to be removed from service? So for example, loose bolts. It could be something other than loose bolts, but it's just a good example.
Throughout the testing process and through the mock testing, there were a number of vehicles that were removed from service. As I mentioned, we asked our staff to be extra diligent in reporting and observing. And we had a number of vehicles, especially on in the early days, where a vehicle was removed because of an unusual sound that the operator heard or a smell that the operator experienced on the train. So extra caution was taken and vehicles were removed from service. There was no safety violations or safety concerns that were identified from these trains that were removed. Some of it was attributed to staff being extra cautious. And then other situations were identified as, this is normal operating practice. And, some of the examples were, we had trains that, the operator reported a noise and, they were brought back into the shop. There was no fault found with the train, but they said, that train probably would need to have its wheels trued. So, they reprofiled the wheel to take away a flat spot. It probably need to have its wheel trued in the next couple of weeks. So let's take the opportunity to do that now. We had a situation during mock service where while the train was in service, one of the headlights went out on the train. So we had to pull that, but there was no safety concerns that were identified. So, as I said, some of it was attributed to the fact that, we asked our staff to be extra cautious and, that's an example of what happened yesterday. The operator of the train heard something, did the right thing, reported it, heard a noise, noise appeared to be getting louder, stopped the train. Safety first. And a technician came, inspected that train, said it's fit to get to Tunney's Pasture. We took it to Tunney's Pasture, let it sit there and, do a more detailed inspection at that point. Nope, that train was fit to return to the maintenance and storage facility, return that at the end of the night to the maintenance and storage facility, and it's going through a more detailed inspection there now. But, our staff and RTM, they're doing the things that we've asked them to do, put safety first, and be extra cautious, extra diligent.
No one can fault the operator for being extra diligent with the noises, and I applaud that operator. I don't know who they are, but if they can hear me, I applaud you on that. So thank you for that. Perhaps you can pass that message along, Mr. Charter. Speaking of noises, there have been a number of... Oh, it looks like Madame Amilcar wants to say something. Is this true? She's putting her hand up, so I'm just...
Chelsea. Thank you, Chair.
I would like to add on. When Mr. Charger talked about the noises, it's normal that a vehicle that was put aside for a little while, it's normal to have unusual noises. There might be a little bit of dust at the wrong place. There might be some... This is what we call wheel flat. This is kind of normal. Know that every single time there's an operator that's putting a new vehicle on the rail, we're proceeding to some tests just to see if, let's say, the headlight is working. It's exactly the same as with a car. If we have a burned headlight, you go through an inspection and a repair. So we have a document to fill with all the security point. And until we have that complete list, the vehicle is immobilized. So this is very important to remember. And Chair, if I may say, we have our specialists on the call today. I don't know if we forget to mention it. So if you do have any technical questions, we have our specialist on the line today.
Thank you, Renny.
Okay, I'm going to continue with my question, if that's okay. So I understand that some wheel noise is expected. Steel wheels, steel lines, I get it. And I think most customers get it. I think where people are uncomfortable is that there is increased noise. And I viewed a video this morning that the noises were pretty bad in Rideau. I also have information that the trains are actually traveling slower through Rideau Station. Normal is apparently between 35 and 40 kilometers an hour, and they up until recently were doing 15 kilometers per hour and now are up to 25 kilometers an hour. So we are going slower through the Rideau Station. While it is possible that these noises are normal because the train sat for a while, I think everybody in this meeting can understand why customers are afraid. They are concerned about these noises. They are hyper aware to these noises. And so saying simply that it's normal is not going to calm the fears of our customers, given that we've just gone through two derailments. So are there any issues that are abnormal, that are causing these horrible shrieking and crunching noises that are happening through the tunnels? Is there anything going on that this commission or customers should know about?
I can answer this question. We had a meeting this morning. And actually, we have two meetings per day with our partners. RTG, TRA is also present. There are very specific location at the Rideau Station where we find a noise that is unusual. So our Alstom specialist went for a first verification last year. I mean, the previous year. So we had to grind that rail segment, and we will be able to increase the speed in that section. So it's right in the middle of a tunnel. So we went from 15 to 25 kilometers per hour. This morning, we decided to avoid that noise. And to avoid having concerns, we will change and replace this segment. We will start the works tonight. And then we think the noise will be gone permanently. Once more, I know that I repeat myself. It's normal to have some noises. What is abnormal is not going for an inspection and let it go. So right now, what we do is acting normally. So we're going to send an inspector. This is our responsibility to make a decision to ensure the safety of our system and restore trust in our ridership.
Okay. So that section of track will be replaced, and you hope that will reduce the noise. Okay. Mr. Charter also mentioned during his comments about the testing that operators have reported, in addition to noise, certain smells. It's my understanding that it was a burning smell that was reported. And can you talk about what the cause of that was and what was done to mitigate it?
There were a few occurrences of that, and the one thing we need to keep in mind is we're going into the cold weather months, and this was the first time that the trains, the heating systems were turning on. So similar to you have at a home, sometimes when you turn on that heater for the first time, you smell that, there's a smell that comes out, and some people would describe it as a burning smell. So that's what's been attributed to those smells. It's the first time the cab heaters are turning on. And, there's some dust on there, and it burns off. So we saw that the first couple of days. We haven't seen a return of that. So, all those trains, each one of those trains that was report, Alstom's got a detailed process in which they have for smell and for sounds. They went through their process, verified that everything was in good functioning order, and then the trains were returned to service, after they had completed that inspection process.
Okay, thank you for that. My final question is about payments to RTM. Will RTG RTM be receiving any payments for October of this year or November of this year?
Actually, no. We won't, because they didn't deliver the service. for September for sure, for October neither.
What about November?
November, we'll see, because they had started the service, as I said, and actually we're discussing with legal and commercial to see what we'll do. But for this instance, the good news is that the service has been resumed. So we'll see on the commercial part what can we do. But for sure, they didn't receive any pennies, neither for September nor October.
So, I mean, right. And obviously, we're discussing this with lawyers and I'm pretty sure the chair is going to jump in about Fedco in a minute. But here's what I'm going to say. They're only providing partial service for part of November. And I'm not entirely sure that the public would be supportive of providing RTM with a payment for November, given that they're providing 7 trains for half the month. And so I would be very interested and hope that there will be a memo from either yourself, Madame Amilcar, or Mr. Kanellakos, explaining and telling us about the payment with respect to November. I'd like to make that request when the final decision is made. And I would like that information to be made public, because the public deserves to know how their money is being spent. And in my view, though I don't get to make this decision because I don't sit on Fedco, I'm not entirely sure they should be getting any money from us for a month where it's half the month and they're only giving us 7 trains when the service agreement is many, many more trains. So that's just my view, and it's not worth much, but we'll go with that. I think those are my questions for now, Mr. Chair. I'd like to let my colleagues have a chance. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Councillor McKinney, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to staff for the update. Want to recognize that everyone is working flat out. I'm sure Renee and Troy and the team are doing everything they can, given the bag they're holding, if you will, the train they're responsible for. So I do want to start by acknowledging the work that's being done by our staff at this point. I did have questions about the noise. I mean, it's no secret. We've seen it on social media. People are posting. Remember, my family takes the train every day, so I hear about some of the details. They're huge fans of the train, but I do hear about some of the details. And there is at one point in between, and I've heard this from a few people, and I have not experienced it, but there's one point between Rideau Station and U of O where the train really does slow down to almost a crawl. And I just wonder if we've assessed that, if RTA, RTM, although I'm not sure that I have a lot of trust in their assessment, but certainly TRA or staff have assessed that slow movement at that point in the track. And if you have any notion as to what is why we have to slow the train down in the manner that we are.
Chair, I think I explained that I know that we have a problem at the Rideau Station, and tonight we'll replace this portion of the rail to make sure that we don't have this noise anymore. So maybe if Daniel or Ken from TRA can provide more information regarding that.
Thank you. And just thank you for that. I just want to be clear, though. There's the noise part that was brought up from the last commissioner who questioned it. But this is a portion of the track where the train really is slowing down significantly in between. So I just want to make sure that my question is specific to that movement.
Did somebody from TRA want to add to Renee's comments?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Councillor McKinney. Just quickly for our work for TRA, that specific area is not something that we've concentrated on specifically in that area at this point. But I have ridden a number of trains here over the last few weeks, and will do so again this week during my time here in Ottawa. So I will look specifically at that. And try to figure out how that might fit in with the ongoing monitoring that we're doing as well.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And if that could be part of an update back to us, just to so that we get an understanding as to why that is occurring. That's all my questions for now, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Councillor McKinney. So next up is Councillor Brockington.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to you and colleagues. To staff, if a operator approaches a bus stop and a customer is not wearing a mask, what is the procedure?
Pat, do you have the sensor, please?
I'm sorry, I don't. Jim's on the call and would probably know better than I would.
Yes, hello, Chair. The procedure is the passenger would be allowed onto the bus. We do not want to have our operators in a position, in a confrontational position or so. All of our customers are required to wear a mask. However, we don't know their personal information. We don't have any idea of the reasons why they cannot wear a mask. So the customer would be allowed to board the bus.
Attending a public meeting last night, and there were concerns expressed that people are observed daily on buses. The example given was a bus, but I'm sure it's a train as well, of folks not wearing a mask. And I acknowledge that there are people who have legitimate reasons for not wearing a mask. And yes, we want to avoid that confrontation, but for people whose only means of transportation is the bus or LRT, and they have concerns about obviously acquiring COVID, seeing people unmask is alarming. So, and so the operator does not call that into security. There's no opportunity for education. Do we have automated messaging that can be played on board the bus to remind passengers to wear masks? Do we have that?
Well, we do have regular communications with our operators. We have professional operators out on the road that are driving these buses. They if they find they have a questionable situation, they know to call into the control room where they have the resources made available to them through the control room that would meet up with them along route or at the next station and possibly deal with an individual that may be not in compliance with the mask, but we have to be very respectful because not everybody can wear a mask, and we need to be respectful for people's situations, and we would deal with it on an individual basis. So we would, but the operators do have the ability to call it in and, you know, and deal with it on an individual basis if they're questionable. But in the most part, our customers are wearing their masks. We've done many mask enforcements. The compliance rate is very high. So I think everybody is adhering to the policies, and there are some that need to be addressed, but it's few and far between.
Well, I see it daily.
Okay.
I see it daily myself. So it is happening. It is a concern. I do agree that we want to avoid confrontation, but we also want to avoid getting COVID. That fine balance we have to walk. Are there automated messages that can be played on the bus or train? We have messages that reinforce other issues that we want to communicate to our passengers. Do we have anything related to COVID?
I would defer that to Pat. As for now, I believe we're just doing the code 50s out from the control room, advising the operators to just be aware of situations and monitor them closely. I don't believe there's any automated messages out right now.
Mr. Chair, there was last year a general automated announcement that went to everyone, but I will take the councillor's question to find out whether there's an automated announcement that can be actuated by the operator of that particular bus. And I'll get back to him on that, if that's
okay. Thanks very much. Yeah, it's not just for passengers. If you looked at before vaccinations rolled out in large quantities, our operators were getting COVID. We had a fair number of staff that were getting COVID. I'll just transition to the ridership numbers. Thanks again, Mr. Scrimgeour, for this data. You had mentioned bus ridership in October, 41%, para 59%. Can I just be reminded the September bus ridership number, was it in and around 40%?
The September number, Mr. Chair, for bus and train operation in that month was 45% of 2019 numbers.
So I'm just trying to look at bus. Obviously, we don't have LRT running in October. Is the October 41% higher than September? You mentioned September's number was blended with LRT.
For both, it's all customers who are using the conventional system, so okay. All services that are not paratranspo. To be precise, I've got the number very nearby. One moment. In September 2021, we carried 4 million customers. In October, we carried 3.9 million customers.
So even with R1 service, with LRT offline, we lost ridership. Would that be a fair conclusion?
Our ridership that month went down by approximately 100,000.
Even though, yeah.
So not even though, I mean, we think that some people chose either not to travel or other means of travel during the time that the R1 buses were in operation because the service was so much less convenient and so much slower. And that's why we were so eager to get the trains back
once for sure.
We knew that we could do so safely.
But we all agree there is a direct correlation. When the LRT line went down, we lost ridership.
It is likely true. From these numbers that I have, I cannot say it's absolutely true.
Well, I'm a stats guy, and I would make that conclusion. I would make that conclusion. We lost ridership, and when LRT is not running, we know this city hurts. People who continue to take transit hurt, and the data is what we use to make those types of conclusions. So thank you. The following message or question based on previous questions this morning about concerns that our riders have and perhaps a heightened anxiety to get back on the train when we've had issues. Again, if there's any type of messaging reinforcing to customers that certain sounds on the train are normal, if you ride the subway in Montreal or Toronto, you do hear squealing and noises and again, if we can, whatever we can do to lessen people's anxiety by sharing information, reinforcing that certain things are normal. It may sound odd to have to do this, but to Commissioner Wright Gilbert's point, if there's anything we can do to reassure riders, I just want staff to think about that because I think it can help the overall experience. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Councillor Brockington. To Councillor Brockington's point about the masks, Renee, last year we had done a couple of blitzes on the masks. I wonder if that's something we can arrange to do in the near future, just as a reminder to the ridership to wear a mask if possible.
Yeah. Yes, Chair, we can. And what I can say too, it's je vois souvent les autobus, puis sur la girouette, c'est écrit que OC Transpo oblige le port du masque. Donc,
so when I take the bus, and every time that you're going on, there's a message on the bus saying that the mask is compulsory. So it's on the front door. It's on the door.
Right. Thank you. What we did is reinforce those signs, Renee, with our OC Transport security folks, and they could approach people and encourage them to wear a mask. At one point, we were even offering masks in case somebody forgot their mask. There's things we can do to enhance that because we're going into the winter. The numbers are going up. Councillor Brockington made several good points on that. So if there's something additionally we could do, it'd be appreciated. Okay, next up is Councillor Gower.
Thank you very much. I do have this question about our customers. How do we know how many customers that we have? How do you proceed with your estimations? What's the formula? In general, in Montreal, we have some scanners. This is what we use to see how many passengers that we have and how many customers. We also know how many clients we have by the numbers of passes that are bought every single day. And every time they tap their card on our machines, this is how we know how many people are writing our system. Maybe my colleague can complement my answer.
Terminology we use in English here in Ottawa. The three ways we have of knowing how many people are traveling is we know how many passes we sell, how many individual fares we sell, how much cash we receive. That is one thing that is certain, and we calculate across the whole system, and that's the numbers I've reported here. In addition, we have on many of our buses, but not yet all, automatic passenger counters, infrared detectors that are over the doors that are registered to the location of the bus and give us statistics on how many people are getting on and off each trip at each stop, which we aggregate up in a giant database. And the third is that we have the information from the smart card reader as people tap their Presto card or UPass as they board the bus.
Alors, cet automne, quelle tendance percevez-vous?
So what are the trends observed right now? Is there a difference between downtown and other locations? Do we have more customers in some specific locations? Is there a difference in the way people is using public transit? When we're going to tackle the budget, we will go into that level of detail. We are actually looking at ridership. In general, I can already tell you that it depends on what public health will say. In Montreal, people are allowed now to go back to work. So people are allowed now to go back to building. So people can go back to work if they want at the SPM in Montreal. We also know that we're going to have a hybrid working way. So a public servant may not go back every single day to their previous buildings. So in the budget, we believe that public servant will not go back downtown in Ottawa 5 days a week. So behaviors will change. What we want to do at OC Transpo is be there and offer them the service that they need, making sure that they're able to go to work. We don't want to do the opposite. We don't want to wait for our customers to come before offering the service. So we want to be there, ready to provide them a level of service. Instead of having peaks, we're going to have a flattening. So we will have so many passengers throughout the day. So we have to make sure that we have a service throughout the day for our passengers.
Okay, merci. And my last question has to do with TRA and the contract. What's the plan to continue with TRA? As well, the oversight by OC Transpo. Okay. Supervisation for Rideau Transit. What's your short-term and long-term plan? Mr. Chair, discussions took place with TRA. What we've asked with the city manager, Mr. Kanellakos, is that we'll need TRA as long as we need TRA, which means that they had a very clear mandate to explain why there were two derailments. So we resumed a partial service that will gradually become complete. And right now, TRA is still supervising and monitoring everything that was set up now. And all this is done as a teamwork. You know, that's important for us because TRA is providing excellent service. We're very happy with them. But they wouldn't exist if OC Transpo and RTG would not exist. So, and personally, I asked TRA to come along with me and my team to set up a more robust system so that we can have an overview on preventive maintenance, predictive maintenance, to have a plan, to have KPIs, a performance indicator, so that we can anticipate any kind of issue. So if we could do preventative maintenance, but it was not done, we have to correct during service, and that's what we don't want. But if we do all our preventive maintenance and we still have service issues, it means that we need to have predictive maintenance. So even before there is an issue, there's a problem, we have to be able to know that after a certain number of kilometers, we have to change a part to avoid any kind of problem or service stoppage. So that's what we're looking at now with TRA. And that's on a long-term basis. With RTG and Alstom, they have procedures. We are not going to reinvent the wheel with them. But instead of still put the emphasis on the commercial aspect, because performance indicators, you know, there are very, very many commercially. But I want us to continue to have an oversight over that, but I want performance indicator on service delivery, on service reliability, and long-term service. So that's teamwork that must continue on the commercial aspect and the client aspect. And today I'm saying that if we can find the issues, you know, we will get also to the commercial indicators. Okay, I think we should resume this discussion over the next months. So thank you very much, Mrs. Amilcar. I like your attitude and your approach and your focus on the client service. It's excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Gower. So next up is going to be Councillor Kavanaugh, and Vice Chair Cloutier is going to take over for a couple of minutes.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for my colleagues for their previous questions. I was interested in terms of the passenger count, because I'm wondering how you're going to do that in December and when there's no fares. And also how to break it down if there's new ridership of who was attracted because it was there was no fares.
Pat, do you mm-hmm. can you please?
So as I said, we have multiple data sources. The one data source that we won't have will be pass sales. The other data source that we won't have will be smart card taps. We will continue to have data from the automatic passenger counters on the buses, where we will count the number of people who are getting on and off, and we'll for trips. So we'll cycle the buses over all trips. So we'll capture them all over a month, and we will compare them to previous months to see whether ridership is higher. We still, even though the fare gates will all be locked open at the O-Train stations, there are infrared detectors that count the number of people who are walking through those fare gates, and we'll be able to count the numbers of people walking in and the number of people walking out, and we'll make comparisons to previous months. We will not know for certain. We'll try to corroborate this with other data sources as possible, but we won't be able to absolutely tell the difference between more customers who are traveling because of the fare, the no charge transit, or the number of people who are traveling because they've changed their travel needs or because public health restrictions have changed. But we will be able to give an estimate of how many people have traveled on OC Transpo during December.
Yeah, and we won't know if they're seniors or if it's women or men or anything like that. We won't have any details. So is there any way of figuring that out? I realize that's a big ask, but I'm just wondering. It might be useful.
I understand the interest in it. I don't think there's a way that we could collect that data reliably. We could, you know, try some spot checks and look and see who's there to see whether there's any trends, but that would be hard to generalize over the whole system.
Okay. Thank you. Winter's coming today, and I'd like to get more detail about what is being done to prepare after there's been issues in warm weather and kind of nice weather with the service. Winter is definitely a challenge here. What extra efforts are being made to deal with the weather?
Chair, I can answer that. Yesterday, during our meeting with RTG and TRA, we asked this question because we have a lot of indicators that we follow with them to make sure that everything will be okay. And Troy provided me an update very late yesterday, and I was very, very happy because it's better than last year. It's not perfect yet, but it's better. And we will continue to follow that. And what I explained earlier about having a list of the preventive maintenance and it's kind of things because before the winter's coming, we need during the autumn to do things, and some of them will do perfect. Remove the snow, it will be done when it will be necessary. But changing the cabinet heater, something like that, it has to be done further. Before the winter's coming. So those kind of thing will continue to follow them, and we'll make sure that we improve. And those indicators, for me, it will be my responsibility to share them to you both, to you all during those kind of meeting. For me, it's important to let you know what is coming and what we were supposed to do and what we have done, and I will give you an appreciation. For sure, I won't go in details because I think it's my part of job with my team to do so, but I have, and I feel that it's required from my part to bring you, okay, I feel comfortable, what about I saw, and I don't feel comfortable, and this is the action plan.
Okay, thank you. There was some questions earlier about noise and about with the line. I don't think that ever happened with the Trillium line. Why is there issues with the line for Confederation? Is it to do with curves? Is that the reason we have more noise factors for the Confederation line?
Chair, this is a good question. Troy has worked on the Trillium line, so probably Troy, you know better than I, but one thing, it's Trillium was diesel and those are electric. So, we have kind of tunnel from I think it's lion to rideau. I'm not sure. So probably it's louder too. But try if you have more information, please.
That's a very good question, Mr. Chair. You know, and Councillor, you're right. One of the factors that does play into it is curves. You know, the Trillium line in its current formation or current alignment is fairly straight. There's only a couple curves. That is a piece because all rail systems have a certain amount of noise when you go around curves. So that's normal. You know, as Madame Amilcar mentioned as well, you know, the Trillium line, it's heavy rail. They're heavier vehicles. And they interact with the rail line differently. But I also just want to remind everyone that we mentioned at I think a previous meeting that you know, we did the rail grinding this past summer, which we saw some improvements in terms of the noise and vibration that customers would have experienced. But one of the outstanding items is that RTM is undertaking a detailed, what we call a wheel-rail interface, how the wheels of the train interact with the track. And they're expecting to get that those results of that analysis this December, and that's going to inform future decisions as to how we can further improve the noise and vibration. So there's still more work to be done on the noise side of things, and you know, and that work is progressing.
And I appreciate it because, of course, I'm hoping there'll be lots of lessons learned while we get to stage two, because that's certainly a constant question since it's going to be much closer to housing and neighborhoods for stage two. So I appreciate the work that's being done on that. In terms of growth of our numbers, and I don't know if you consider this a budget question, but in terms of how we're attracting people back, we're offering no fare in December, and I don't know about January, how people will feel about going back. But one of them is just this feeling of security. My colleague mentioned about sometimes people aren't wearing masks, and so that will make others nervous. But what other provisions are we looking at? Because it's confidence that people need for it. And I know you guys have been doing a great job on cleaning. That is there. But it's just that a feeling that, you know, I'm going to be sitting beside a stranger or in a crowded situation. What messages, what confidence can we give people that they can get back?
Chair, we have we provide on the budget. I think it's $650,000. I think for marketing, yeah. Mm-hmm. And definitely we have to increase the communication to our clients. Are as you said, wearing masks and. Put the emphasis to that it's COVID safe to take the public transport, and it's that we continue to clean everywhere, even if people get vaccinated, etc. So I think Pat, maybe you can continue. What else do we provide to attract?
In those, so we've been putting out messages since very early in the pandemic to show customers what we're doing, how we're keeping the system safe for them. Those messages all continue, but we also will, if the funding for the marketing campaign is approved in the budget, we'll be rolling those same messages on and carrying them right through and delivering the message about how it's safe and what we are doing and exemplifying how we're making it safe, not just saying it. Putting that together with the other information we'll give customers about, you know, ways that transit can help them to complete their trips in the city.
Is there a partnership with Ottawa Public Health?
Absolutely. Everything we say is in alignment with Ottawa Public Health.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Councillor Kavanaugh. Next up is Commissioner Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question of Mr. Guerra, if I may. If he's on the line, I think he is. Okay.
Yes. I'm here.
Thank you, Mr. Guerra. I think everyone recognizes that the success of RTM, you guys doing your job well, basically the foundation of success for basically the entire rail system. And in that regard, I want you to succeed. I badly want you to succeed. In fact, probably more than anything. And I'm a big Toronto Maple Leafs fan. And I just wonder if you can tell me with confidence, if you can tell us all today with confidence that the worst days are behind us and better days start today.
So I can tell you that the system that we delivered to you is better than the one that was shut down some weeks ago. We've done a lot of work. We took advantage of the shutdown period to do a lot of work on the vehicles to address a lot of backlog issues. In working in partnership with TRA and the city, we've established some very solid long-term goals around quality control, around safety management, and we will continue to work with TRA to ensure that the commitments that we made in our return to service plan around all those areas, that we follow through, we and our subcontractor follow through. So I can say with a great degree of confidence that the system that the citizens of Ottawa have today is a better one than the one that unfortunately was taken out of service some time ago.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Guerra. Mr. Chairman, that's the only question I have. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much, Commissioner. Next up is Councillor Fleury. Councillor Fleury? Okay, we'll go to Councillor Leeper, please.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, everyone. I just wanted to follow up on the question of the TRA contract that Commissioner Gower brought up. Can I get some understanding of what the scope of that contract is today and what the end date is? Is it an open-ended contract? Are we week to week, month to month?
Chair, actually, as you know, the first part of the contract, it was to help to go to the root cause and analysis of the two derailments. And actually, TRA will continue to oversight, and we will put other things in place. So, as I said earlier, we need to put a better regard about the preventive maintenance and predictive maintenance and those kind of things. So I asked TRA to continue to help us to put in place a robust structure. So we don't know yet how long it will take to do so, but we can provide you this information lately.
Okay, so it's a list of deliverables. So the contract will end when a defined list of deliverables is concluded?
Kind of.
Okay, I'd be interested in knowing that. I think the residents of Ottawa and certainly councillors have taken some confidence in TRA's know-how. I'm glad that they continue to be on the job. And I would like the specifics of what they've been retained to do, what the end date is, particularly if there are any thresholds. Are there clear thresholds at which that relationship will cease? When they have delivered X, Y, and Z, then the relationship ceases. So that would be very good to have. And I would suggest a memo would be the best way to do that. And then how much is TRA being paid for this work? And how are we going to recover that?
This is a... Does someone here know that? I don't know.
And I want to be really clear. I'm not going to begrudge money spent with TRA, but it would be good to know what that dollar figure looks like.
Yeah, I will come back with this answer. Sorry, okay. I don't have the answer.
I can answer what's been paid to date, and that we are looking to recover the costs through the contractual recourse. I had that discussion with Mr. Morgan, so. That is going to be pursued through that. To date, we've paid TRA just over $140,000.
That seems very low. Daniel's nodding. Kenneth is nodding. Yes, that is. Okay, I think I will wait for some further details with respect to the specifics of that contract, which if it could be distributed as a memo, I'd be grateful. And then yesterday, a train, obviously an operator determined to take that out of service. I'll echo Commissioner Wright Gilbert's thanks to that operator. And I do want to say I'm very pleased that our operators feel empowered to make those decisions. That's indicative of the kind of culture that we need to have. What is TRA's role in the investigation of whether or not that train is ready to go back into service? Is this something that they are working on?
TRA could answer, yeah.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Councillor Lieber. We're engaged sort of at two levels here. One is sort of tactical in that we have reviewed, I think it was actually during my last trip here, I'm losing count at this point, but we did a hands-on review with RTG subcontractors, with Alstom, of the inspection that they use specifically geared towards noises and vibrations and those sorts of things. So there's a 10-point inspection that they use, and it's a fairly rigorous process, specifically to investigate any noises that might be reported. So I think it was last week. Again, I'm losing track. It might have been the week before. But I was under one of the trains in the shop last week to go through that process with Alstom, understand how it works, to see what the inspected elements were and how that corresponded to their written procedures. So that's one area of engagement. And then the other is really, you know, as everybody's talked about here this morning, the reporting of issues, you know, the identification of issues is an important indicator that the process is working. So we are also very interested from a process perspective that that 10-point inspection that I just talked through is implemented consistently, is documented consistently, and that the results from that are credible. So we have tried to look at it again, you know, at sort of two levels, both at a very tactical level to understand nuts and bolts, what it is that Alstom looks at in those inspections, and then at a higher level to ensure that process is applied consistently. And I should also mention that those discussions, there's a detailed discussion of a detailed review of every train, excuse me, that exhibits any kind of noise, any kind of vibration, typically once to twice a day. There's ongoing meetings specifically around the status of service and any trains that might have even the smallest exception during service. And we are present for each one of those meetings as well to review the process.
Okay, so yesterday a train was taken out of service. Have you undertaken an audit of whether or not the appropriate follow-up investigation and assessment was done?
Yes, sir. So okay. So when that train was identified as making a noise yesterday, I'm actually in the office right next to Mr. Charter here okay. right now. So yesterday afternoon, he and the Chief Safety Officer, Mr. Richards, and I immediately went to Mr. Charter's office, reviewed current status at that time and what was known then. And again, that specific train was reviewed as part of the daily meeting this morning at 9 o'clock, that daily review meeting. And then pending activities here today, I may also have a chance to look at that at MSF as well. But certainly, yes, we're engaged in that.
Okay. And Mr. Charter, who will do that oversight of whether or not the appropriate investigation has been done of reported incidents when TRA is gone? Are we prepared to take that on fully without TRA's involvement?
Mr. Chair, it's a very good question, and that's part of the long-term plan that we have with TRA. So we do have a small team that does provide oversight activities. We know now, obviously, that we need to enhance that and make that more robust, less focused on the contractual side of things. So that's part of the work plan with TRA is working with them closely, looking at our oversight plans, where there's gaps, where we need to improve. And as well, it's, you know, it's imparting their knowledge and their experience on my team and continuing to bolster that. So that's part of the long-term plan. We will be ready for that. We do have a group that does that now. Part of that as well is how we're growing that oversight team as part of the budget process as well.
Okay. So, and I'm guessing then that is part of what I'll see as the deliverables that are scoped out in the contract that we currently have with TRA then. Understood. You're nodding. Excellent. Chair. Yeah, no worries. Chair, those are my questions. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Councillor Leeper. Next up is Commissioner Caricato, please.
Hi, everyone. While we have TRA with us, is it all right, Chair, if I ask them a question?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So it's a pretty general question, but it's one that I've had on my mind for quite some time. And I think a lot of residents of Ottawa do as well. And it's got to do with the system more generally. And, we've been told time and time again, we have the world-class, amazing LRT system. Now, you've worked on several other train systems around the world and in North America. And I was wondering if you could just comment broadly on your opinion of our system and whether it is truly a world-class system or do we have a lemon?
Sure. Mr. Chair, and thank you, Councillor. I was very impressed the first time that I got to ride trains during testing a couple of weeks ago now as the mock service resumed. From my personal opinion, I'm sort of a transit buff. It's what we do. I was very impressed with the system, with the look and feel of the system, and the way that it operates. And now over the past few days, I had the opportunity to see passengers return. I think it's a very good system personally. Certainly we've seen LRT systems in other cities that are more sparing or maybe are configured differently. But I think that from a design perspective, from an execution perspective, it's a really an excellent system.
If I could add to my colleague Daniel, and you raise it's a good question and a fair question. And the bottom line is no, it is not a law. There's no aspect of it that strikes me as being inherently defective or deficient. Much to my family's dismay over the years, I'm a big transit fan. So when we travel, whether it's around the country or the world, we have to ride transit wherever we go. And you've got a great system. Whether or not every aspect of it is performing as well as it can, well, that's why we're here. And that's why we're here to make improvements and to see if we can tweak it and get it where it needs to be. But in terms of the engineering, the design, the layout, all the aspects of it, whether it's the customer-facing aspects or the parts that nobody sees, there is nothing inherently deficient about it, and there's nothing that can't be fixed.
That's really reassuring. Thank you to both of you for your comments. Are there issues, I guess, that you've identified that might, happen in, say, 5 years from now? I'm thinking when you buy a house, you have an inspector come in and check it out and they kind of provide you with a bit of an assessment of what needs to be done in the first year you buy the house and 5 years after you buy the house and sort of longer term. Are there any things that you can disclose today that you've come across that we can, look forward to, I guess?
Go ahead, Ken.
Well, the one thing I can guarantee you, just like your home, is that it will be nothing but more and more maintenance as the system ages. I once had the unfortunate job of telling a general manager during the ribbon cutting, when he was so proud of the fact with the big cartoon scissors cutting the ribbon, that now the hard work starts. And the minute it starts, you have to start doing preventive maintenance. So you have to plan for the fact that things will wear out. Components will wear out. They have a specific useful life. Every aspect of it will have to be replaced at some point, and those all cost money and they require additional resources. So, it's keeping up with that, ensuring that you don't have deferred maintenance. That is the worst thing that can happen, is deferring maintenance and lacking the adequate resources to keep up with maintenance on a day-to-day basis is a death spiral. And we've all seen and heard of different either transportation agencies or other infrastructure components where the minute you defer maintenance, bad things happen long term. So the short answer is everything needs to be examined. And the older it gets, the more examination it needs, and the more you have to increase your inspections. So as all the different components get closer to the end of their useful life, you have to spend a lot more time taking care of them. It doesn't mean any of them just immediately one day they're fine, one day they die. They just require more maintenance. Many aspects that become obsolete can still be kept in a state of good repair by increasing the level of maintenance and inspection being done. But as the system ages, it will require more and more oversight and more resources devoted to making sure that it stays in a state of good repair. I wondered if I could just get back to one more question that was asked about this incident yesterday. And if it puts your mind at ease, every significant anomaly that's occurring right now, whether it's on a vehicle, whether it's on the overhead contact system, whether it's on track structures, we're engaged in that. So when it's reported, we are actually meeting about that and finding out what's going on. Is it following the process that's been identified? Are people doing the right stuff? And have they done the right stuff before it comes back to service? And it's not that we doubt OC Transpo staff to do that. It's just that we independently want to verify that all those things are being done, given the criticality of where we are right now.
That's great. I think there's this common thought out in the community that you buy a new car, you expect it to be running perfectly well on day one or year one. So it is reassuring to hear from you that. We will, and it's normal that we're having these issues. And just what's abnormal, I guess, is the number of issues we've had so soon to our launch, I guess, is what I'm hearing today. And it'll be our job as commissioners to stay on top of OC Transpo staff, even after you leave, to make sure that we're not deferring any maintenance and that, things are being repaired and fixed as they should. Thank you so much for that, those answers. And I don't have any further questions, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioner. So next up is Councillor Fleury, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to come back to two points. My intervention today really related to R1, but I think two points were raised that are compelling for me to engage on. Madame Amilcar, a number of your teams were responding earlier to the wearing of masks. And I think OC Transpo is a little soft from the perspective of if today someone walks into a grocery store, even if it's an essential service, they're required to wear a mask. And those who can't wear a mask are used to it and have the appropriate documentation or information. So you have clerks in grocery stores having to interact with folks who aren't wearing masks, and they do provide masks if the person doesn't have it. I wonder why OC Transpo is not more upfront on that, and why aren't we engaging with operators? Because everyone else wearing a mask is worried about their own safety in that environment. And I think we do have we've had many conversations at the Transit Commission relating to people's safety and driver safety. And I think that is one where we do have to be upfront and be clear on our expectation of mask wearing, because the majority are complying and the majority are worried.
Chair, premièrement, au niveau des chauffeurs.
First of all, when we're talking about bus drivers, it's very difficult for us to ask them to police mask use, because if they do that, they're not driving. So through communications, verbal and nonverbal, we're raising the awareness of everyone. But personally, I will not ask our drivers to actually intervene because of their own safety. When we have a store or an OC Transp location, you have to wear a mask. In some location, we have a security agent they will be responsible of asking for the mask. It will not be the cashier. It will not be the attendant. So I will talk to my team to see how we can raise awareness, how our security team are working, and how we can help them with compulsory mask wearing. What we're doing is trying to convince people to get vaccinated so we can go back to almost a normal life instead of policing passengers and customers that for a reason or another is not wearing a mask. That person should be allowed to ride our buses, go to the supermarket. But when I listened to the different discussions this morning, it's not normal to have so many people without a mask. Without having to do anything else, I will ask my team to proceed with a survey to see what are the statistics about unmasked customer? Is it 10%? Is it 5% of our riders without a mask? Then we will be able to reevaluate the situation and see if we have to have extra actions. We can do many things, but it's also a question of budget. Health is very important. But the measures in place for the compulsory mask wearing are there. But there's always some fees linked to these measures. So, Mr. President, let me work with my team to see how we can quantify how many riders are not using a mask. Thank you. Thank you for your interventions, but I have two more elements. Today, what we could do is go to Ottawa Public Health and making sure that people are wearing their mask and that the bus driver could actually intervene and tell them to wear their mask. We have a lot of standards at the City of Ottawa. If someone is going to one of our installation, it will be the attendant at the door that will run after the customer to tell them to wear a mask. So why not our drivers? Because we own these buses, we own the train and our recreational installations. So maybe we talked to the general manager of our different recreational installation, and they have to intervene. I do have another question on a different topic, though. I think it was Councillor Kavanaugh that talked about leadership, ridership, sorry. In December, it will be free. Will you have a ridership analysis and the demographic analysis? I think we need more information on who's going or who's using the system, such as we know that, let's say, a bus is very full at one point. This is how people are using the system. So it can be through the Presto card scans. It can be through different means, scanners. I would like to know what tools do you have and how do you use them? Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Stringer explained the systems that we have in place. So we have the monthly passes. This is one way that we evaluate riderships. We also have daily passes and tickets. And like you mentioned, Councillor Fleury,
Est-ce que Councillor Kavanaugh a demandé,
like Councillor Kavanaugh asked,
démographie, comment, quel est le comportement, quel âge,
we want to learn more about the behaviors of our riders. Are they students? Are they workers? Where are they coming from? Where are they going? This is a very distinct study. It's very difficult. In Montreal, we were proceeding with such a study every 5 years. What we can do are projections, because we work on budget, we're looking at level of service. So we adapt the service when school starts again. We will reduce it in the summer when school ends. So we do have tools, but we also have to use estimates. It's a mathematical formula. We will use historical data, as well as what we can expect. So let's say that we have a festival. We know that we're going to have more tourists. So it will be more riders over a 10-day period instead of a one-day period. So it's not always very clear. But we're going to have different iterations, making sure that we are flexible enough to adapt the service to the needs. So sometimes we're able to plan over, let's say, 6 months period. Then a few days after, we have to make some alterations. Sometimes we don't plan an event, but we have to readjust. So Mr. Skinner may complement my answer. But in short, we have a lot of analysis to do on the long terms. We're using estimates, and we're doing a daily observation of what's going on. So these are the tools that we're using for our estimates.
I don't have anything to add unless there's any specific questions I can help with.
Well, so I want to understand maybe the additional follow-up. So every time someone jumps on a bus, taps a Presto, that's an origin. We know where they've taken a step onto the bus, but we just don't know when they exit. So we don't have an exact volume of folks at a given time on a particular bus. Is there not a tool that could give us that indicator? Because my following question to Madame Milka will be on the R1, and I think, you know, that the choices of R1 to me have been challenging for local routes, and I want to understand what tools we have to make those decisions as accurately as possible.
So first of all, when people board the bus, we have a count of them boarding, and we have their identity, because not their personal identity, but we know that it's a particular serial number as they tap their smart card. When they get off the bus, we know how many got off the bus. What we don't have is the particular serial numbers of the smart cards as they get off the bus. But most people make their next trip from very close to the point where they got off the bus. So if somebody traveled to Sirville Station in the morning, they might get on the bus at Sirville Station in the afternoon. And so when we see that same serial number being tapped at a location later in the day, we can surmise that that's probably pretty close to where they got off earlier that day. So we can match up individual people's trip patterns, if we have to, from where they get on and where they get on again with their smart card. But usually we don't need to do that. Usually we're using the APC data, the automatic passenger counter data, that count everyone who gets on the bus, everyone who gets off the bus, the time and the location where they do it. And that's our primary way of knowing how many people use each stop, our primary way of knowing at what times of the day people use each stop and each trip. And also that tells us how many people are on each trip at its busiest point or at other points on the line. So that's also the way that we check that buses are or are not crowded to the point that they need more service added. We know that there's, to take an example of a 40-foot bus, there's 30 people on the bus at its busiest point, which might be at, you know, Cumberland and Rideau, then we don't need to add more service. If we see that number getting closer to 40, 45, 50, we know that it's time to be rearranging the schedule and putting another trip in there or sending a larger capacity bus. So we're using all of these data sources all the time to make the decisions to fulfill the service standards that you and council have set out for us.
Okay. I'll come back to that because I do see some layers, but I don't see the real time, and I the impact I feel is in real time. So I want to come back to the R1. So I wrote to the chair and Madame Amico as well, and you've responded. I just want to understand a little clearer. So I'm personally concerned with decisions that were made and selections of routes that were done for the R1. We're now at the end of the current period for the use of the R1. I hear you. What review are you and the team undertaking to bring a little more policy environment to future R1 route selection?
Well, you passed that question on to the chair. The chair passed it on to me, and we are doing that work, and we'll be back to the chair and to you as we complete that work about the the geographic aspects of where trips were removed. I'll go back and find some notes, and we can reshare them from notes that we provided earlier. I think it was in September, where we said very deliberately what the steps were we took in deciding where would be the least harmful to customers to remove trips in order to sustain the R1 service, recognizing that every trip that we removed hurt the customers who would normally be on that trip and the customers who would normally be on the trip after that. So every decision to remove any trip was taken very carefully, and to hit the right balance between the negative impact that was definitely there for customers on that trip and on the trip following, and our necessity to have enough capacity on the R1 service to keep what became for that 2-month period the spine of our network, to keep it having sufficient capacity to move all the people.
45 seconds left.
Yeah, I, Pat, I appreciate your answer. I'm not looking for a Matt Fleury response. I'm looking for a Transit Commission engagement on the policy for use of R1. So is there an intention to come back with an IPD on what approach is used for the R1? Like, I'm just looking for a little clarity on that specific. This is not a personal project. This is a, hey, let's have a policy conversation on how R1 is selected and what framework exists around that.
So we provided that information in September, and if it's helpful, we can forward it so you can review it again, or whatever the chair would prefer us to do.
My understanding is what was shared in September was routes that were being canceled with some context to why those, but not a fulsome policy environment. So maybe we can take it offline, Pat, but I am looking for a form of an IPD back to to Transit Commission on the selection of R1 supplemental routes, I guess, or routes.
So, Mr.
Nate, did you want to add something to this? Renee?
Oui, merci, Monsieur President. Ce qu'il faut,
thank you, Mr. Chair. What we need to understand here, let's say that we have, let's say that we have a subway system or a train. This is what we call mass transportation. So sometimes we're removing some services in some services to maintain what we call a mass transportation line. It's very difficult to have a formula to see where we're going to cut. What we need to do is to have a good level of service. When we're doing our planning and we're making a decision, this is a decision made with data available at a fixed point in time. At one moment, it may be very specific, but it's not taken into account in a general formula. And at one point, a sector can be underserved. What we could do is talk together when we're going to meet. But it's important to understand. In 20 years of experience, it's a request that I had many, many times. People are looking for formula. It doesn't exist. So if you allow me, Mr. President, we can come back on that. So we cannot just have a fixed formula that is applied every single time because we're going to have real service problems. Yes, I would love to talk about it with you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm done.
Good. Thank you, Renee. Is that it, Councillor Fleury?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. We'll go to Commissioner Wright-Gilbert, please.
Oh, I thought that Councillor Menard had questions, and since this would be my second round, I thought Councillor Menard
should. Sure, if you want him to go first, that's fine. Councillor Menard?
I'm always happy for that.
Oh, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. I don't have too many questions. I'll try to keep them short. On the UPass, the free transit for December, institutions are responsible for reimbursing students, as I understand it. And I just wanted to hear from staff, have those institutions communicated that they will be doing that? They have every intention to do so, to reimburse students for the month of free December, free transit in December for the UPass, the cost for that particular month.
Mr. Chair, we've begun discussions with those institutions. To this point, they haven't, at least to my knowledge, they haven't raised any statements that they would have any difficulty in refunding those to the students.
Okay, thank you for that. I wanted to go now to the media report out today on the 48-hour pause memo. It's indicating in there that a few things. The first is around the memo that wasn't sent to council. So after 3 days of testing, RTG and the city agreed to stop the trial run for 48 hours. There was a memo that was drafted by OC Transpo staff to council explaining the performance over the first 3 days of the trial running has resulted in the decision to pause the ongoing system assessment. That was never sent to us. I just wanted to get clarification on why that wasn't sent to us. I'm seeing something reported here, but I want to get further clarification why that memo wasn't sent to council at that time.
Okay, Councilor Menard, that story just came out today. Those questions are all related to FEDCO because that's where those decisions were taken. This is, as discussed before, the Transit Commission is to do with the operational part. We didn't assume the LRT until it was operational, so after what that story is talking about. So the question would be out of order here, but it certainly applies at the next FEDCO meeting.
Okay, disappointing as usual, Chair. I'll move on to other questions then. There seems to be an issue with the delivery of the trains. So I just wanted to hear from staff, the initial delivery of trains, because we got a tranche first and then we got more as time went on. Are those initial trains that were delivered, are they having more substandard response and performance than the trains that were delivered subsequently to them?
Does somebody want to take that?
Monsieur le Président, je peux répondre.
Mr. Chair, I can answer. This is exactly what the indicators that we want to set up. Like we talked before, we're looking at performance KPIs. So we have commercial indicators, we have indicators for our riderships, but we're looking for other indicators to see how each vehicle performs. We're not talking about trains, we're talking about module. We want also to do a cross data verification of how many kilometers have been ridden by each vehicle. And right now, we would like to use these indicators for predictive maintenance. So just by the way the vehicle performs, we will know if we have to change an element, a part, proactively. So this is the type of analysis that we want to make with our partner, RTG. And we're going to use TRA, that's working with us tonight, right now, to work on that.
Okay. Let me ask in a different way. The 7 sets of trains that we have running right now, as we did before, are those trains that were delivered later, or were those the early trains? Is there a mix? Give me an idea of what's on the line right now in terms of delivery, when those were delivered.
Chair, maybe Troy or maybe RTG could say that, because normally we have 29 vehicles and we couple them. So we can pick and choose, and I'm not sure if we go by the first one or the last one, we can couple them together. So try to have more information regarding that, or maybe Mr. Guerra could say how does it take this decision?
Sure, I'll jump in, and then I'll let Mario, Mr. Guerra, to provide some additional context. So, to answer your question, I believe there is a mix of vehicles that are in service right now. I know Ms. Amakar talked about, key performance metrics, and that's definitely the path we need to move forward. But anecdotally, and I'll ask Mr. Guerra to provide a bit more information on that, it appears that, the issues that we're experiencing on the vehicles, it's more related to kilometers traveled and years of service, as opposed to whether it's a new vehicle or an older vehicle. They are in the building of these vehicles, they are applying the lessons learned and the fixes before they get delivered here. Now, some of those vehicles were delivered before, we knew some of these challenges, but, that is being incorporated into the stage 2 fleet. And as I said, I think, what we're seeing, right, at least anecdotally, is the issues are more a function of mileage and years of service as opposed to when they were actually delivered to us. But, Mr. Guerra, if you could add some additional information, that would be great.
Yes, thank you. So, Mr. Chair, we currently have 39 cars that have been received and have gone through the required testing so that they can be used for service. Of those 39, 34 would have been part of the original order. So 5 of those cars are part of the stage 2 order, and we continue to accept more stage 2 vehicles as time goes on.
Okay. So as we accept those stage 2 vehicles, are we inserting those are we seeing better performance from those vehicles, from those stage 2 vehicles being delivered and those later vehicles being delivered, than the performance in the other vehicles that have, again, run for a little bit longer? I'll ask for an email follow-up from this to know exactly what is on the line, when they were delivered, and the length of kilometers that they've driven, because it seems to me we had a lot of early issues and that there were fixes. As I understand it, I had asked a couple years ago or a year ago about fixes being done to the new trains being constructed that were being delivered to us, and amelioration that was to occur as a result of those issues that we had experienced right out the gate. So I'm just wondering how much better the performance is for those new vehicles being delivered to us, given all of the issues that we've seen with the vehicles thus far.
So, Mr. Chair, as I think Troy alluded to, a lot of the issues are kilometer based. So I'll answer you a couple of questions. The first question is, once a vehicle, a stage two car, is deemed acceptable, has gone through its burn-in rates, has had all the retrofits to bring it up to where it needs to be, then we will immediately put that train into service and try and put as many kilometers on it as we possibly can to shake out any issues that may come. So for me to say that stage two vehicles are more reliable than stage one is, I mean, we can certainly take that away, Mr. Chair, and do a little bit more study on it. But I would say probably not. I think the issue would be the same once they've traveled so many kilometers. But it's certainly something we can look at.
Okay, thank you for that. And please do follow up with email, I guess, Troy, that would be you, or I'm not sure who, Mario and Troy. But it would be helpful to get that by email. The other question I wanted to raise is around, refund policy. And I don't necessarily mean a warranty in returning a train, but is there any policy in there for a financial restitution for the vehicles that we've had delivered to date? If there's some that are particularly worse than others, or is it only that the only recourse is repair of function? Is there anything else? I'm particularly interested in refund information.
I think Councilmember,
given the operation.
Yeah, that should also go to FEDCO because that's related to the contract that FEDCO monitors and put in place. So, if what you're looking for is the language of the contract, I'd ask you to take it to FEDCO. If you're asking if we're in the process of trying to get a refund or something like that, then that I think could be answered here possibly for you.
Sure. Are we in the process of trying to get a refund?
Troy, would you be able to take that? Or?
Monsieur le Président, je peux peut-être prendre un petit bout au fait.
Maybe I can start. Regarding a warranty, we follow commercial indicators, so we cannot necessarily ask RTG to give us another train. We will ask for a train performance, and it's up to RTG to determine if the train can't deliver that performance. Well, it's up to them to make the decision to get a new train. We have to control the safety aspect, but the reliability aspect is RTG responsibility. They must make that train reliable so that we have the service we paid for.
Okay. So just so I'm getting it clearly, we are beholden to RTG on any type of refund or warranty with the subcontractor, Alstom, with the vehicle contractor, Alstom. Am I basically right? Or does the city have more authority than I'm indicating?
I'm not sure if I entirely follow the question, Councillor. I know that we're leveraging everything we can in the PA in terms of the penalties and the failure points, and we continue to update FEDCO on those things. And we continue to engage with Sharon Vogel from the outside legal services, in how we apply the contract. So we're leveraging the things we can, but I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, you're not. The question's clear.
Councilman Arad, let's...
It's not about a legal issue. It's just about the basics of the operation of these trains, Chair. So right. I'm just wondering, does the city itself have the ability to request either a refund or any type of warranty? Or is that RTG's responsibility, as Madame Amilcar has mentioned?
We'll put that question to Sharon Vogel at FEDCO because it's related to the contract and what would take place in FEDCO and not here. Look, everybody else in this meeting today has been able to understand what's FEDCO and what's transit. So you're walking that thin line. Part of this I can see is transit issues, but a lot of it is FEDCO related. And you know, it's not the people that are on this call that would be involved in that process. It would be Sharon and others that would be doing it. So let's put the question to them at VETCO. It's a very good question. Let's put it to them and get everybody an answer to it. Would that be okay?
No, I'd actually like it in writing this week. So I don't want to wait to FEDCO again. So I've asked for two things in writing now. This is the second thing that I'd like in writing. So if staff can please follow up with me on that exact information that I've requested, that would be helpful. The other issue I wanted to raise, Chair, is the launch of the system. We've heard, given the operation after the launch, Chair, very clearly that things were not going well in the testing phase. And it appears that we launched too soon, given the operational issues. I'd like to hear from staff on their view of that, given what we've seen.
You're talking about the launch we just did now, or are you talking about the original launch 2 years ago?
The operational issues from the original launch 2 years ago.
Okay, well, the testing was before the operational launch. So again, that was all taken care of through FEDCO. If you recall, we went to FEDCO for all the briefings on what was going on in that time period.
So, I think staff are prepared to respond, Chair, if you can just let that happen.
No, I'm ruling the question out of order, Councillor Menard, so it doesn't matter. Okay, so if you don't have anything related to what we're dealing with now, I'm going to move on to Councillor Eglah. Okay?
No, I'll challenge the chair then, because these are operational questions. We're experiencing operational issues. I'm talking about the operation of the train after it was launched and the issues that occurred as a result of launching that train too soon. These are operational issues we're experiencing as a result of decisions made back then. So I'm asking the question very clearly to staff. It should be in order here. These are Mr. operational Chair, issues.
I also challenge your ruling. Could we keep this, please?
Okay. Could the committee coordinator poll the commission to see if they want staff to try to answer that question here, or does it go to FEDCO, which was the chair's ruling?
So, Chair, I see the deputy clerk.
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification, if the committee coordinator or the clerk staff could be clear on what the question is. Usually the question is, shall the chair be sustained? And I just want clarity on that.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. We would move to a vote on the question of shall the chair be sustained. A vote of yes sustains the chair.
Good.
Thank you.
Commissioner Brockington.
No.
Commissioner Caricato. Commissioner, you're muted. Oh.
Sorry, I had to step out. I missed the last part.
The motion is on whether the chair is sustained. Yes, sustains the chair. Nay is to overrule the chair.
I missed the entire exchange, so I don't think it's fair that I vote. Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, we're in your hands in terms of whether with the will of the commission, would clarify the ruling upon which commission is voting.
Okay. The way I understood the question, Councillor Menard was asking about staff's opinion of what took place during the testing of the trains before they became operational and whether or not that testing impacted any issues that came out after the launch. Is that correct, Councillor Menard? Am I reading your question right?
It is the operational issues that we experienced after the train was launched. And I have a question about the issues with launching that train, given the operational issues that we experienced.
So you want
the vote is whether or not we have to ask.
Is that what you're looking for? So we can be clear. I can change my ruling if you can be more clear with your question. Is it that you're asking them whether or not the trains should have been launched after testing?
My question specifically was around the operational issues experienced after the launch of the train, given the issues prior to the launch of the train that experienced that were revealed today. So though they're related, they're all operational issues. It's not to do with financing or anything else like that. It's an operational structure of the train.
Okay, then for the benefit of the commission, what I'll do is withdraw the ruling, and staff, if you can answer that, if not, refer it, please, to the staff for FEDCO.
Thank you.
Renee, are you prepared to offer an analysis on issues that happen immediately after launch?
Well, I can give you my opinion from my past experience. When you're launching a new metro, a new bus, that there's a new technology, frequently we have a list of a list gathers so that the launch is a success. From my experience, very often, however, there are things that we were wishing for, but that we can't really have. And we will, if safety is assured, we will proceed with the launch. So in my experience, it's never true that 100% of the things that we have predicted before the launch will happen, but this is how we learn to with this new technology. So from what I understand, it was the same situation with the light rail in Ottawa, because it's a complex system. We are experiencing it now before I even got here, and probably the decisions made were the right ones back then. But today, with our experience, maybe we can say with hindsight, well, maybe we should have waited. But I think that now we are just learning from this experience so that we do better next time. So I wouldn't want to be a judge today and say that the decisions made 2 years ago were not the right ones, because maybe we would still be testing today and we would never have launched it. So the experience we have now today would not be the same.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Renee. TRA, if we could ask you to, if possible, to comment on whether any of the issues that you're finding in what you're reviewing for us now, do any of these issues trace back to 2 years ago, September, October?
Mr. Chair, for my part, I don't know that I have enough information to answer that question. So I would need to do a little bit more digging into some more historical documents to get to a good answer on that.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Okay, so Councillor Aguilar, you're up next.
I'll just ask, Chair, that staff include that in the email. So that's the third piece of information that we haven't got enough information on today. So thank you.
Sure. Councillor Aguilar?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning to Zamalkar. I don't think we've actually had a chance to meet even virtually, so welcome to the city. And I appreciate your earlier comments and the challenge that you and your team have in putting the train back online and satisfying the concerns of the public. And I know you're all working hard at that, so I do appreciate that. I guess my question for you and perhaps for TRA firstly, I echo Councillor Leeper's comments. I think at 141,000 Canadian, you're a bargain. Appreciate the work that you're doing. But I guess what I'm asking is, have we sat down and thought about how we take the work that TRA is doing around creating a successful operational system that's reliable and safe, have we sat down and talked about their recommendations, their findings, and how that can be incorporated into stage two so that we don't, or I'm not going to say we don't have any bumps in the road when stage two opens, but that we use what we've learned from TRA to minimize that impact. So do we have a system, a process in place to take the work that TRA is doing and incorporate it into our planning for the rollout of stage two?
Monsieur le Président,
Mr. Chair, TRA's work with us, it was short term, but is becoming long term now, as we said earlier. And all the best practices that are being put in place will, of course, be used for the extension, Eastern one and Western one. And it will also influence our reflection for the Trillium Line too. It's not only for OC Transpo. This is a good way to work. And what's new here in Ottawa is this partnership to learn to work with a partner, because at OC Transpo we were independent, you know, for the buses, but now we have to work with a partner, and they are the technical experts, but we must maintain an oversight, a close oversight, to ensure safety, reliability, and to be in a position to offer a good service. So all the work that's been done now, yes, definitely, it will be exportable, if I may say so. And it will apply in the future.
So just a quick follow-up. And I get what you're saying, but I guess what I'm asking is, do the contractors and eventually the operators who will be maintaining the system understand what you've just said, that what we're finding out in these reviews, that they will need to incorporate it that into how they carry on their business as usual going forward? I guess where it's coming from is we're seeing improvements right now, but we're seeing improvements, I think, in part because you're onto them, you know, quite significantly, and TRA is on them quite significantly. But I guess what I'm saying is, can we expect that they will absorb this and it will become normal business for them? So there's not this constant need to perform oversight and bring in external people to watch over them. I'd like to hear that our partners, as you put it, are getting the message as well and understand that they need to incorporate these changes and these processes going forward into stage two. Do you get that sense?
Alors, Monsieur le Président, si vous permettez,
if I may, Mr. Chair, the marriage is for life here, right? The union is for life. So are we condemned to always work closely with RTG? Yes, we can never let them go. Even before TRA got here, and I said it earlier, maybe we put a lot of emphasis on the commercial aspect and we didn't put enough on the client aspect. And it's that gap here that we're living today, because people work really, really hard to have oversight on that. And now we're trying to make a transfer so that we put a lot of emphasis on the deliverables. That's what will help us reach our commercial objectives. And they are accompanying us. And RTG too. RTG will commit itself, and it's the request of TRA to in commit to implement these measures. It's not something that we're doing today and never again. No, that's why I'm talking about a robust system. We can't just say, we found the reasons of the two derailments and then we're going away. No, we realize with our reviews that there were some shortfalls in terms of follow-up indicators. I'm an engineer, and as you know, I work only with indicators that talks to me. So it tells me if I must go right or left. Today, I don't have enough indicators talking to me. So that's what we need. Once we have these indicators, we will be able to make the right decisions to know what needs to be done. And that will be done with our partners. Without RTG, without OC Transpo, without TRA, we don't have a train. It is really a partnership job. And this job will be done on a long-term basis.
So just quickly to build on your analogy then, if I'm hearing you correctly, we're going to require TRA to remain in the role of the marriage counselor, if you will, for some time to come. Is that fair?
Our objective is to become autonomous. We will learn from their experience. Mr. Charter said it earlier. We are now rethinking with the other teams, rethinking how we will make sure there's a follow-up, but to transfer this follow-up, commercial client, that's the key. Because people were doing excellent work before. In French, there's an expression that says the operation was a success, but someone died. No, what we want, the follow-up we need, we want it to have a direct impact on the client service. If we reach this objective with the client, we will on the commercial side too. And that's what I want to do with TRA and the team that's there already. We have to bring everybody to be able to do that part. And you'll be the first one to say, oh, you don't have the commercial objectives here. But those two elements must communicate together. They must complement each other. And that's TRA will be helping us to do that. But of course, our objective is to have an OC Transpo that's independent. Doesn't mean that we won't need peer review. Everywhere in transit, in a transit business, we're always looking for someone with more experience that saw more things than us to influence us. And the best businesses in the world work like this. They always strive to improve themselves. So I can't tell you today that I won't need someone to help me out, because there's always someone that will know more than me. But we will influence each other to change our way of working to become more independent, more autonomous. We won't need that constantly, but every now and then we will need to consult like this, like with a group like TRA to help us do better work.
Thanks for that. And I think everybody around the table would agree it's a good sign to know when you need help and you need to reach out from peer support or review. So I think that's a good thing. So thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Eglai. Before we go to Commissioner Wright Gilbert, I want to welcome our new Councillor Kathy Curry, who joined us this morning. Welcome, neighbor. And also, we're going to take a break after Commissioner Wright Gilbert's questions. We'll receive the report and then take a break and come back and do the budget. So let's say we break till 12:30, if that's okay. All right, so go ahead, Commissioner Wright Gilbert.
Okay, try to keep this short. I think everyone's hungry. Okay, I still have a couple of follow-up questions just based on sort of some of the discussions. So correct me if I'm wrong, but the life cycle of bearings, axle bearings, is 20 years, correct?
Could RTG answer that, Brendan?
have this answer?
What I was told when I had meetings with RTG and Alstom is that they were 10 years, the mileage based, but Miriam may be able to answer that.
Specifically the axle bearing. I know that the bogey life cycle is typically every 10 years. We can go back and look specifically at the axle bearing, but it'll probably fall within the same life cycle timing.
Okay. So 10 years. Okay. So if we cast our minds back to the August derailment, it's my understanding that 21 bearings total were replaced as a result of the August derailment. And correct me if I'm wrong. If the life cycle is 10 years, why are we replacing 21? What went wrong?
We replaced the ones that failed the test that was put in place through our short-term mitigation, which is to perform the test every 7,500 kilometers. Once the root cause is finalized, which we expect in the coming weeks, then a more permanent retrofit will be put in place to remedy the issue going forward.
Okay. Doesn't really answer my question, though. If the life cycle of these bearings is 10 years, the system's been running for around 2. What went wrong with those bearings, and why did we have to replace 21 of them? What went wrong that they didn't last their life cycle or even their kilometer cycle?
That's the purpose of the root cause, to determine what went wrong and how we can prevent it from happening.
Okay. I'll be really interested to know how we got from 10 years to 2 years. While I have you, RTM, RTG folks, you said earlier in your comments that the shutdown as a result of the derailment allowed you to quote, catch up on a backlog of maintenance issues. Why were these maintenance issues so backlogged? Why were they not being dealt with as part of a regular maintenance schedule? Why did we have so many issues backlogged?
Maybe I misspoke. What I meant to say was that it presented an opportunity for us to accelerate the remedying of a backlog that we had on the infrastructure and on the vehicles. It's perfectly acceptable, and TRA can speak to it just as well as I can, for vehicles and infrastructure and items to have backlog work that's not safety or service critical that typically gets addressed when the vehicles are in for inspections. The fact that we weren't putting vehicles out for service presented us with the opportunity to accelerate that and get it done much quicker than we normally would have in an operating environment.
Can TRA please confirm that there were no safety issues that were backlogged?
The work that we concentrated on was ensuring that at the time that service began, that all safety related issues were addressed. And our experience was with the light rail vehicles that all of those, and this maybe goes to your earlier question as well, if I may, all of the vehicles that were cleared and inspected for service, all safety related issues had been addressed at that point. And at risk of getting ahead of Mr. Guerra a little bit, I think the way that we thought about the other inspection and maintenance activities that occurred on the line, on the main line, the right-of-way, and on the stations prior to the initiation of mock service was thinking about those as an opportunity to catch up on the lower priority items. So the ones that were not safety related and perhaps the ones that either required more space or time to complete than what might normally be available. Again, as I think Mario said, taking advantage of that time. The other element that was very important in the return to service for stations in particular was to ensure that elements that had not been used, systems that had not been used for some time, such as elevators and escalators, were all current on their inspections and on their maintenance. And we did verify that that was the case, yes.
Okay. So just to be clear, the items that were quote unquote backlogged that were dealt with during the shutdown period, none of them were safety related issues. Is this what we're saying? That they were just minor issues?
Yeah. So I think I would think of them in two categories. There were issues that were not safety issues, lower priority issues that were part of an ongoing maintenance process, as Mr. Guerra mentioned. And then secondarily, things like, again, using the example of elevators and escalators, those are safety critical inspections, but at the same time, they were not necessarily due, just the same as the kilometers-based inspections on the LRVs while the stations were the LRVs were out of service. So those definitely are safety related, but some of those were not performed during the shutdown because of the timing associated with things like repairing LRVs, checking the critical torque connections that we talked about during the last Transit Commission meeting. So they weren't exposed to passengers or to service at that time, though. So part of the idea was to make sure that those safety critical inspections were brought current before the line went back into service.
Okay. If I could add to that, you asked a question, which is it's a good question, but it's a very complicated question. That question is, the line wasn't running for a couple of months, which ones were safety, which ones weren't safety? Our view is if, for example, the day after service was shut down, a vehicle was supposed to get a preventive maintenance inspection or have something inspected, and it didn't for whatever reason, that's safety critical because it wasn't done. But the vehicle wasn't back in service, so it didn't matter that vehicle we were back in service. What was important is that the vehicle had all of those inspections that they were all caught up with prior to it entering back into service again. So the fact that something might have been delayed, yes, it's possible that could have been safety, but the issue was it addressed and remedied prior to them going back in service? And in terms of how many there were or when they occurred, that would require a much more complex analysis to go back and look at every single vehicle and every single safety critical component to see where that was done. Because I know they did change their cycle of maintenance and what they were looking at when the system was shut down. Does that help answer the question?
Absolutely. Thank you. My last question is again for RTG and RTM. So the other statement that you made that really sort of stuck out to me, and you said it quite proudly, was that the system that we have now is much better than what we had before the derailment. Why did it take two derailments to get a safer and better system? What's changed now? You did say it quite proudly. So I want to call you out on that a little bit.
That's fine. That's fair. From a customer-facing perspective, I can give you a few examples. So, for example, you would have noticed that there were some speed restrictions out on the line that were in there for quite a while that we just were not able to get to because of the time that we have during the engineering hours at night. The fact that the system shut down allowed us to go out there with our subcontractors, address all these speed restrictions, so that when we came back into service, we pretty much eliminated all those speed restrictions. From a customer point of view, they no longer had to deal with that anymore. So that's an example of what I meant by the system that we returned back is in a better state than the one that we had going into it.
Okay. I'm going to go to that question. I'm going to caution RTG and RTM about the statements that they've made. There's two statements that you've made today that are causing online fury and confusion, and people are angry. So your statement about, issues being backlogged, you made a sweeping generalized statement with very little context or detail. I'm going to caution you against making those statements, because the fact that we as commissioners have to follow up with you to clarify what you're actually saying doesn't lead to a lot of confidence in RTG RTM. The second statement that you made, that you're saying now it's a much better system than before the derailment, my question of why did it take two derailments is a natural question from what you said. So just so you know, you probably don't know this about me, but my professional life, because this isn't actually my real job, is in communications and stakeholder engagement. So a little free advice for you: do not make sweeping statements like that if you are not going to back them up with contextual information without being asked by a commissioner, because you are doing nothing to restore confidence of the riders in your ability to manage the system. My final question is, and that was free advice for you, final question is, you just made another statement that is now causing me to ask another follow-up question. You said that there were now less slow areas on the tracks. You didn't have to decrease speeds because as a result of the shutdown, which let's be clear, that shutdown was because we had a massive derailment. You can now work on them because in the before times, before we had these massive derailments, you couldn't get to things because of the allotted time for engineers at night. So my question is there an issue with the amount of time that is allotted to your engineers at night when the line is shut down? Do we need to shut down the line for longer at night in order for your engineers to get to these things that are to customers concerning? Or do you need more engineers? What do you need to get these things done in time?
30 seconds left.
Thank you.
The statement was not that we couldn't get to them, that it would have taken us a lot longer to remedy those TSRs.
The quote actually is, we can't get to things because of the time allotted to our engineers, the nighttime shutdown.
Okay. So then I'll correct myself. We can't get to them in as timely a manner as we were able to during the shutdown.
So my question stands. What do you need to get these done in a timely manner?
Well, I think, any transit in the world will tell you that it's a challenge because of the finite number of hours you have in between service and that it needs to be planned and well executed to get to it. And unfortunately, it takes us time to get to some of these issues because of that restraint. I don't think we need anything. I think it is what it is, and we need to work within the confines of those hours as best as we can.
Okay. All right. Let's be honest here. None of your answers give me any confidence in RTG and RTM. I have zero confidence. And I will repeat my caution to you about the statements that you make during this commission. It's being watched live online by transit users. It's being tweeted about. And your statements are causing just a level below panic among transit users, which is not going to help an MML car increase our ridership as we go to discuss the budget next. So I don't know if you have PR people, but I would suggest that you have a discussion with them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, thank you, Commissioner Reich-Gilbert. So, folks, is this report received?
Received.
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 Received. Thank you. Okay, so we'll take a break till 12:30 and come back and start with the budget presentation. Thank you.